The other thing that this story wants to unpack, though, is what I call the shitty technology adoption curve, where when you have a terrible technological idea, you can't just make rich people live with it because they get angry, and when they get angry, people listen to them. So you have to find poor and powerless people and impose your terrible technology on them until you've sanded off the roughest edges and normalized it.
Welcome to How Do You Like It So Far? I'm Colin McClay. And
I'm Henry Jenkins.
This is a podcast about popular culture and social change, and we are thrilled to have Cory Doctorow in the studio today.
Hi there.
All right. Cory is a man who I would say defies description, except for we can say he's Canadian. But beyond that,
we're like everybody else. We're like serial killers. We look just like everyone else, but we're everywhere.
But a little more polite and tending polite. To wake up earlier in the morning.
Yeah.
Appearances of politeness, however, with deep and cutting science fiction, policy work, activism. I think those are a bunch of the, and some commerce too thrown in there.
Disney fandom.
And Disney fandom.
Theme park fandom.
So we thought, because we're about pop culture and social change, we'd start with the pop culture side, but this conversation is not going to stay in a box for very long. But let's start by talking about your new short story collection, Radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a sense of what we'd find there?
Sure. I call them my Trump derangement syndrome stories because I wrote them as a way of trying to make narratives out of the chaos of the Trump years. The intersection of Trump and the engagement maximization algorithms of the social media and online services means that every day you're just sort of bombarded with headlines, and it's never clear what the narrative behind them is. Like, is that terrible thing that I just got worked up about the same terrible thing I was worked up about yesterday, or is it a new terrible thing? And so I started to do what writers do. I started to make narratives out of them, and I ended up accidentally writing 4 novellas while working on another book altogether. The first one is called Unauthorized Bread, and it's a story about people in refugee housing whose appliances are designed to extract as much money from them as possible. So the toaster will only toast bread that comes from an authorized manufacturer, and the washing machine only washes authorized laundry, and the dishwasher only washes authorized dishes. It's about what happens when they all stop working because the hedge funds that back the companies that make these things take them through a tactical bankruptcy. The servers all go down, and the people in there seize the means of computation and become masters of their technical destiny and make them work with every kind of bread and every kind of clothes, and how risky that becomes when the systems are switched back on and they face the possibility of being detected and then charged under the Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which Bill Clinton signed into law in 1998, which makes it a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to jailbreak your appliances, which that part's not science fiction. The second story is called Model Minority. I wrote it after reading Matt Taibbi's amazing book about the murder by the New York Police Department of Eric Garner. And where I had this atavistic reaction of, why doesn't someone interpose their body between racism and that poor man? And I realized that, individual heroics would have no impact on structural racism. So I wrote a superhero story about Superman fighting police violence and about the how quickly you can go from being a white man to being an alien to being not even a man. And how contingent whiteness is on buying into the white power structure. And then the third story is Radicalized. And it's a story that imagines what would happen if the aggrieved white men who today exact their revenge by shooting their intimate partners and brown people at mosques decided instead to murder the healthcare executives who doomed their wives to and children to die long, lingering deaths from preventable illnesses by denying them care for terminal illnesses. And then finally, the last story is The Mask of the Red Death, that is a tale of preppers cowering in a luxury bunker waiting for better people than them to rebuild civilization after a collapse, who discover in the hardest way possible that you can't shoot germs and that we all have a shared microbial destiny, and who end up shitting themselves to death of cholera.
So all of those could have been on the headlines this morning.
Yeah.
Fortunately, unfortunately, we had other headlines that were
equally grim and disturbing.
Yeah, exactly.
So So let's focus on toast for a little bit. That's a story that starts out really on some very mundane detail of everyday life and just keeps opening up and opening up. And it's a good way to think about the role that your blurred identities as a science fiction writer and as a policy advocate come together. Because it does have at the core the Millennial Copyright Act, for example.
Yeah. So Unauthorized Bread is it's trying to unpick a bunch of different things. So one is what it means to live in a world where we have a law on the books that felonizes reconfiguring a device that has some kind of copyright protection built in. Even when you own it, even if you don't infringe anyone's copyright. And so when this was enacted, it was a nuisance designed to backstop ridiculous business models like being able to divide up the world into different DVD regions and sell DVDs at different costs in different countries. And what they wanted to be sure of was that you couldn't just reconfigure your DVD player so you could go to Mexico or India or even just another high-income territory like Europe, where a movie had been released earlier than it was where you were then, and bring it home. So you couldn't get it cheaply. You couldn't get it out of the release window. This is not a copyright infringement. It's really important to note that here to understand the whole context. Like walking into a store in Bangalore or Tijuana or Paris and saying, how much is that authorized licensed DVD, and being told, and then handing over that much money, and then bringing the DVD home to Los Angeles and putting in your DVD player, is the actual opposite of a copyright infringement, right? You paid the rights holder the going amount for their work, and now you're enjoying it in the traditional way. And so they had to make the law independent of copyright infringement. They had to say that breaking a copyright law, even if you never broke copyright law, was itself illegal. And so when this was limited to like Sega Dreamcast and DVD players, it was stupid and gross, but it wasn't an existential crisis. But today, any device that has software in it has a copyrighted work in it. And so that's any device that's smart. And if the device is designed so that using it in a way that's dispreferred by the shareholders requires bypassing a copyright lock, then it suddenly becomes a felony to put third-party ink in your printer or have your GM car fixed by an independent mechanic, or to put apps of your own choosing, like maybe an app that lets you determine in advance whether or not the Hong Kong police are gassing or shooting people before you go to a protest, on your phone without permission from Apple. And so we have this ever-expanding constellation of devices that are off-limits to us. And That's a huge seismic shift. It's also an existential crisis for our species, because one of the things that making devices off limits for reconfiguring does is it also makes them off limits for security research, right? Because if you have to bypass a device's access control in order to find out whether or not a criminal could use it against you, publishing that security research becomes a potential felony because you're telling people how to bypass the access control. And so it allows firms to control not just what their customers do, and not just which interoperable products their competitors can make. It lets them decide who their critics can be and when they can be criticized. So, you know, cybersecurity matters a lot. Cybersecurity is not just about whether your Facebook data leaks. Now it's about whether you get poison loads updating the firmware in your pacemaker or in your anti-lock braking system. It's literally a matter of life and death. And to have cybersecurity contingent on whether or not you are violating a Clinton-era copyright law is just terrible. The other thing that this story wants to unpack, though, is what I call the shitty technology adoption curve, where when you have a terrible technological idea, you can't just make rich people live with it because they get angry, and when they get angry, people listen to them. So you have to find poor and powerless people and impose your terrible technology on them until you've sanded off the roughest edges and normalized it. So terrible technologies start with prisoners, poor people, immigrants, refugees, students, blue-collar workers, mental patients, parolees, and so on. And then we work our way up to everybody. You know, science fiction isn't a predictive literature, but if you want to know what the future of technology, bad technology, looks like, look at the things that we impose on prisoners and children today. That's your life in 20 years. 20 years ago, if you were eating dinner and there was a CCTV watching you, it was because you were in a supermax prison. Now it's because you bought an Apple or Amazon or Google home automation product. And that bad technology adoption curve is best illustrated by starting with people at the bottom of it. And so by starting with refugees, I was able to show where our technological future might lead us. And then the final piece was about how what technology does isn't important, but who it does it for and who it does it to is important. Having a device that like tells you which toast, which bread you should put in it to get optimal toast is a feature. Having a device that lets the shareholders decide which bread you can use is a bug, right? And the only difference is whether or not you get to decide what constitutes good bread or bad bread, right? The actual feature itself is totally neutral. So it's the power relations that are most important. And so seizing the means of computation, right? Seizing control of your technological destiny, that is the difference between utopia and dystopia, not what the technology itself does.
I mean, as I was listening to the book, as I had the audio version, at first I was like, oh, this is a little bit overstated. Come on, come on. And then before you know it, I was right there and I was like, yes, of course, I can see this. This is not 20 years out. This is around the corner. These are my razor blades. This is a natural ecosystem. These are business plays. This is going to happen. And it became increasingly like I got enveloped, absolutely enveloped in that story. And I was like, yeah, I can see this trajectory happening. And so I found it a really effective way of science fiction-ish or near future-ish storytelling, but that did, as the, you know, a person who's interested in the relevant policies, able to like absolutely tap into that and tap into the outrage, right? And also the hope associated with the potential to reclaim your computational future, recognizing that that's a complicated potential for policy, technology, education, all these other reasons. But like that, you know, and that sort of imbalance of power in the immigrant community in the story absolutely is like gut-wrenching. It's like the people in the bottom of the pyramid are getting shit on yet again and have no recourse, right? So it spoke to today in a very real way for me.
Yeah, and you know, my watchword I take from the title of an old Michael Weinberg legal paper, white paper he wrote for Public Knowledge about 3D printing and copyright and patents. It's, this will all be so great if we don't screw it up. The thing about technology that gets me so worked up about it is not that I don't like technology. It's that I really like technology and I would like it to be used in ways that are good for human thriving instead of for extracting value from humans in the name of feeding these transhuman colony organisms that treat humans like gut flora that we call limited liability companies.
There's so many places I'd go with this. I mean, one of them is the deep ambivalence I feel. So for instance, at a school we visited recently, a middle school, they're now going to give iPads to all the kids as like a great example of a technology for consumption, not for one necessarily of creation. And it just took me back to kind of Read, Write, Web and how we are teaching, you know, sort of the values that we still instill in folks and the tools and the limits that we place against hacking and playing with technology and repurposing it and doing the exploration that any of us would do with any sort of traditional non-digital technology and that we should absolutely be doing in this space and feeling like, you know, this is not a new battle that we're talking about. I guess a question for you is, as you look at that, you know, look at the last 20 years, for instance, or 25 years since the, since that 1998 bill, where would you say that we are in that arc? Have things gotten worse in terms of the kind of hackability and control back to the hands of non-corporations and non-LLCs? Has it gotten worse, better? Where do you think we are or going?
Well, I think our legal framework got a lot worse. There's an idea that I'm really enamored of called adversarial interoperability. That's not, you know, like I think most people are familiar with interoperability. You know, it's the idea that like, you can use anyone's screws with your drill, for example, and you don't have to buy the drill manufacturer's screws to hang up a picture. And that's what you might call indifferent interoperability, like Bosch doesn't care whose screws you buy. And then there's kind of consensual interoperability. Apple really wants its developers to use its toolkits. They have lots of documentation. Here's how you do it. But then there's adversarial interoperability or non-consensual interoperability. So when Facebook was kicking off, one of the things they made was a tool to allow MySpace users to still be Facebook users without leaving behind their MySpace friends. And it was a bot that would pretend to be you, log into Facebook, get your waiting MySpace messages and put them in your Facebook inbox so you could reply to them there. That's like third-party printer ink or like any other technology that plugs into an existing one in order to challenge its dominance. That's really, really important. Now, the tools for that have never been better. You know, like we've never had more technical documentation, more pre-built libraries, more collaboration tools like GitHub and all the other Git servers that are public on the web. better cultures of code creation, co-creation of technological projects, and so on. But at the same time, the legal framework is worse than it's ever been. So every company that is today one of the big tech giants has in its history an adversarial interoperability story. You know, Microsoft was stopped from killing Apple when Apple made an iWork compatible, the iWork compatible suite that could read and write all of the Microsoft Office documents without Microsoft's permission, right? Today, Apple uses the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to punish third parties who make, say, things that can read and write iTunes libraries without their permission, even though there's no difference between the two. By the same token, you know, Facebook obviously has lots of adversarial interoperability in its history. Google would never have been able to crawl the web and present itself to every website as though it were just another web browser and gather up all of the pages on that website if adversarial interoperability wasn't legal. But every one of these firms has sought and secured either new laws or new judicial interpretations of existing laws that snuff out the same activities that they engaged in. They've taken out patents on things that were not patentable when they started out. They have advanced theories under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. They've advanced theories of tortious interference with contract for people who violate their terms of service. And so, you know, they've gone up the ladder and they've pulled it up behind them. So it's a paradoxical moment, right? So on the one hand, we have this incredible bounty of tools for those who would figure out how to bypass the controls. And on the other hand, we have this incredible set of legal consequences for people who do these things that have been normal since the year dot.
So I've long been interested in the role that hacking plays in your stories as a kind of core civic literacy or competency.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously speaks to you as a policy person, but it also fits within the genre trajectory of science fiction, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a much more social notion of hacking than the early cyberpunk writers who had the hacker cowboy versus the corporation, and yet you're operating to some degree in the same terms of that.
Yeah.
Or we've talked before about my idea that every apocalyptic science fiction novel usually has a resistance movement. And how it works through resistance seems a really important thing. So I'm just curious your thoughts about the role of hacking in mm-hmm. your work, and both as a policy person and as a science fiction writer.
Yeah, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with STEM education and iPads. You know, the earliest STEM education, you know, the stuff that they were talking about in Computer Liberation magazine was not vocational. Right. It wasn't like, let us teach our kids to be programmers so they can found tech startups. It was self-defense. It's what Doug Rushkoff calls programmer be programmed. Right. And the idea was that computers were amazing, also scary, and they were coming. And soon everything in our world will be shot through with computers, that you know, our buildings would become elaborate cases for computers. This new building that we're in now, if you take the computers out, it would be effectively uninhabitable. And if you left them out for any length of time, you'd probably have to scrape it down to the foundation slab because it's got really good insulation and the humidity would build up and it would fill up with black mold and that would be the end of it. You know, from the seismic dampers to the door locks, this building is just a giant computer in a fancy, fancy concrete and steel and alloy case, right? So the idea of early STEM education was that unless you understood how those computers worked, they would be used against you. And there is nothing wrong with a sandboxed environment that is forgiving, like an iPad. The thing that's wrong with it is not how it works, but how it fails, right? When you run up against the limits of the sandbox and you're like, all right, now I am ready to start rethinking the parameters of my sandbox instead of revealing another layer beneath it, the way, say, Minecraft does, right? Where you can delve in and make new bricks and do all kinds of things. The iPad, when you get to the limits of it, you either confront the glue seals around it and the fact that Apple takes active countermeasures to stop you from opening it up and seeing how it works and changing things, or from buying third-party parts, going even so far as to suborning the Customs and Border Patrol to seize and destroy original Apple parts that are sold used and re-imported back into the US. And you also run up against the technical limitations of the software, where if you try to change the bootloader, if you try to change the firmware, you run up against not only the technical countermeasures that Apple has taken, but if you found a way around them and you published them, you would find yourself on the wrong end of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And so the failure mode of wanting to do something that Apple hasn't thought about is pretty terrible, right? And, you know, Apple's argument that people prefer it that way is belied by the countermeasure. You know, as Ed Felton says, keeping honest users honest is like keeping tall users tall. If users really genuinely prefer not being able to change their bootloaders, then you wouldn't need any locks on the bootloader because no user would try to change it. Right? The only reason to have a lock on the bootloader is to stop the user who wants to change it from changing it. I'm not talking about trusted computing applications to allow users to validate the bootloader, to install their own keys, their own password. I'm just talking about a thing where under no circumstances do users get to decide what happens to the OS, where it's always the manufacturer. So, you know, to return to this question you asked Henry about cyberpunk and about hacking and its role in fiction, you're right that the early cyberpunks were not very technically literate, with the exception of Rudy Rucker. And, you know, in particular, you know, Bill Gibson says that he was attuned to the poetics of technical jargon and not its specifics. And I'm the last person in the world to decry them for the lack of technical nous, because the stuff that they did was really important artistically and in terms of the way that it influenced not just a generation of writer, but a generation of technologists in instilling that kind of punk DIY, if you can't open it, you don't own it, ethic in us. But I think that the first order result of that was a widespread belief among writers who weren't cyberpunk, but were donning cyberpunk garb for their films and books and so on, people making Mission Impossible movies, that the technology didn't matter, that you could rejig the technology to accomplish whatever it was the plot demanded. Do you need a cipher that lasts forever and can't be broken? Okay, we've got one of those. Do you need a cipher that only lasts for 25 minutes and lends itself to a countdown timer? We've got one of those too. The reality is that if you're using a cipher that only lasts 25 minutes, you're an idiot. Right? Those ciphers don't exist, right? We just have ciphers that, as far as we can tell, work. We might be wrong, but as far as we can tell, they work, right? And when I say work, I mean you could turn every hydrogen atom in the universe into a computer and try to guess the key, and you would run out of universe before you ran out of possible keys to guess. That was pretty catastrophic, and it lent us both some very bad intuitions about the role of technology in solving and creating problems. And it created a lot of really lazy storytelling. And, you know, one of the things that I think has made my work last long, even though it's generally caught up in the technology at the moment, it's all kind of near futurish, is that the problems that it poses and the solutions that the characters come to are all grounded in the very slow-moving world of computer science, as opposed to the fast-moving world of computer engineering. And those computer science problems, because they are slow moving and because the policy problems that they pose are therefore not likely to be solved with computer engineering because the underlying science is stable, those problems continue to resonate with whatever it is I write about. So I wrote Little Brother in 2006 and it came out in 2008. It's 2019 and people are still reading it and talking about it as though it were very contemporary and important, because the way that the people use the technology and the problems that the technology poses for them are all grounded in actual computer science.
So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about, as another kind of manifestation or place that your interests kind of come together, in the Boing Boing community website, news service, commerce area, and just talk about where that came from and how you see that as connecting to your policy interests and this kind of the hacker ethos and some of the stuff we're talking about now, and how bringing those sensibilities into popular culture in that, you know, through that vector. How do you think about that?
Yeah, Boing Boing's an interesting beast. I've been writing it now for the better part of 20 years.
Wow.
And I write it almost every day. I think, you know, I probably missed fewer than 60 days in 19 years, or however many years it's been. And what I do with it is everything that crosses my transom that seems like it is significant, I try to write up what it was about it that made my, that got my antenna, that snagged my attention. And I try to write it for a notional third party, a stranger, which you know, lots of people keep notebooks, but if you're keeping a notebook that a stranger has to be able to read, then you can't cheat yourself, right? You know, there's plenty of notes I've made for myself where I was like, I'm sure I put enough detail in to later know what I meant. And I go back and I read it and I have no idea. In fact, I have story ideas that I've written out where I can't delete them, even though I have no idea what they mean, because all I remember about them was how great they seemed in the moment. And then I go back and I look at them like, what the hell was this story idea for? So writing it for third parties is really important. And then there are these feedback loops, right? So I, on the one hand, I get this, you know, super saturated solution of fragmentary ideas that comes about as the, as like kind of a mnemonic function of writing stuff up in detail. And they can like nucleate and crystallize into speeches and stories and novels and, you know, nonfiction books and essays and whatever. But on the other hand, I get this community of people who have the same interests as me or who have some interests that intersect with mine, who send me suggestions, who annotate my posts with their comments and so on, which helps me find the connections, helps me hone my rhetoric, helps me find where the things that I'm writing aren't being understood by notional strangers and tells me where I'm not explaining well enough. And then finally, there's the piece where it actually becomes part of the discourse, where, you know, because we have several million readers a month, when you write about it, it can become part of the way that we think about it in the world. And, you know, it can become influential. Not everything we write has a huge impact, but some of the things we write have these very, very big impacts. They go around the web. And, you know, as an activist, I my framework for change is the Lawrence Lessig framework, that we are regulated by code and law and norms and markets. And that Boing Boing is a normative tool, is a way to nudge the conversation that we have about our technical concepts. It's also something of a calling card, right? So it's the things I write about on Boing Boing are things that sometimes snag the attention of people whose audiences are disjoint from ours, you know, editors of other websites, editors of newspapers, magazines, and so on, who will then say, I read this thing that you wrote on Boing Boing. Will you write something that's tailored to our audience for us? And that's where you get a lot more cultural currency. It's not that it's on Boing Boing. Mm-hmm. It's that putting it on Boing Boing got me somewhere else to write about it as well.
Well, I like that notion of Boing Boing as a normative tool, because it sort of points toward a direction I've been thinking about lately, which is policy statements as speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That is the sense, I use the Green New Deal as an example of something that projects a future and proposes solutions to it, not with necessarily the hopes of becoming law, but with the hopes of shifting norms and generating further speculation and discussion. It's like science fiction, a provocation. And in that case, it helps that AOC actually made an animated science fiction short to explain the impact of the law. So I'm wondering to what degree, when we think about policy, I know we're dealing with real things and policy lends itself to law, but to what degree or do you see policy statements as doing some of the same kind of provocation that science fiction can do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that policy is grounded in narrative, right? Policy is rarely here's what is true and what is false. It's here's what is possible and what is impossible. Or here is what is moral and what is immoral. And that's always framed around a narrative discussion of human nature and the world that we live in. You know, the incentives matter, right? The rallying cry of the Reagan right. As they, whenever they would slash social services, they would say incentives matter. When you let people thrive without having to work, you encourage them not to work. And so we just can't help children of poor parents with healthcare and housing and education. We have to put limits on that, because if you could get exactly the same benefits for your children without having a job as you do if you're a CEO, then who would ever want to become a CEO, right? And so that is like, I think that's wrong, but it is the narrative that underpins the policy. You see this a lot in austerity, right? Whenever austerity comes up, the rubric of austerity is always that a household can't live beyond its means. Households don't issue their own sovereign currencies, though, right? Like, there are some really important differences between balancing your checkbook and being the central banker of a sovereign currency issuer. Really, really important differences. It's a bit like comparing the sun to your oven. You know, like the you know, yes, they are both sources of heat, and you know, yes, you can use either one of them to cook a hot dog, but the similarities end there, right? So I'm writing a Green New Deal novel right now. It's the next book I'm going to write, and you know, one of the things that's challenging me is thinking about how those policy fights will be overcome, and particularly what's going to happen with the partial successes. It's really a truth and reconciliation novel, because one of the things that I've become increasingly aware of is that no revolution has ever figured out what to do with the losers. You know, Canada, where I'm from, is full of the descendants of empire loyalists who are still pissed off about the houses in New England that were stolen by American revolutionaries from their ancestors, just like Cuba is full of Cuban exiles who are angry about the property that was nationalized by Castro. And the South is full of aggrieved white people who have had manufactured narrative about the Civil War that really is actually pretty recent. I mean, all the Civil War statues they didn't go up after the Civil War. They went up in the, you know, 40s and 50s as a part of a racial project, right? But who are able to be mobilized with this narrative about being downtrodden losers, even, you know, in Donetsk. You know, what do you do with the Russians who felt triumphant, the ethnically Russian Ukrainians who felt triumphant in their relationship to Ukraine, who then felt like they had been knocked back by it, right? Yes, the little green men from Russia actually executed the coup, but everything that I've read and heard suggests that they did so with the enthusiastic cooperation of many of the people of Russian descent in that part of Ukraine. And so I'm writing a novel now about what the Green New Deal will do with the people who were climate deniers, who were austerity hawks, who were, you know, free market cultists, Ayn Rand cultists. Those people aren't going to go away, right? And, you know, sending them to the gulag doesn't solve the problem, as we've learned. You know, sending them north for re-education didn't clear up all of the people of who doubted the gospel of Chairman Mao. And so I think that, like, putting that in our imagination, like, not only are we going to have a Green New Deal, but we're going to have a Green New Deal in which we coexist somehow with the people who never liked the idea and still don't like it even after it's been proven out, is actually a really important piece of imaginary work, because it helps us tell those people where their place might be even if they never come around to our point of view, and even if we succeed. And I think that that is a really important piece of how you eventually find truth and reconciliation, because one of the problems of truth and reconciliation is when your entire identity is framed as this oppositional role, you don't know what to do when you've lost. You know, do you become the underground? You know, or do you become a partisan fighter hiding in the woods and slashing tires? Like, It's imagining a peaceful coexistence is really hard.
My immediate reaction is that that's the moment that we're in now, right? Where as 10 or 20 years ago, I think we would have all expected, you know, that we could disagree and then still move on. And now we don't feel like we're in that political mm-hmm. moment. And then on a day-to-day basis, right? And it's hard to see how we come out of it. And then here you take the greatest problem of our age, thus elevating the conversation. It's not just politics. This is literally existential. And what happens after? And how are we ever? And so it asks the same question that we need to be asking ourselves now: is we've got to be able to get along. So I think that's prescient to take that on, and really interesting to go back to what Henry was saying about kind of norms and sort of saying, dropping some seeds there and saying, like, we can imagine that future. If we can't imagine, I think the work that Henry and Sangeeta do, if we can't imagine a future in which there is that reconciliation and where there is some sort of possible future for folks who were deniers or were in some of our views, bad actors, for whatever reason, then unlikely that we're ever going to get there. And if they are, and if they do end up slashing tires or doing, you know, whatever seeing other versions of protest against greenness, right? That's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I really think that there's a role to be played there, right? For people to be able to imagine it. And, you know, part of my theory of change is that the less coordination that we have to do, the easier it will be for us to succeed, right? That coordination is a necessary evil, in the kind of Coasean framework. You know, Coase won the not really a Nobel Prize in economics for writing this paper, The Theory of the Firm, where he says that the reason we make institutions is to coordinate our labor. That, you know, it's all well and good for us to have a factory where we're knitting sweaters, but if it turns out that half of us are unraveling them while the other half of us are knitting them, then we need to have a meeting to make sure that we know when the unraveling is going on and when the knitting is taking place. And that meeting is time that we're not spending unraveling or knitting. And what networks do is they lower coordination costs. They allow us not just to find people who might want to work on projects with us, although that is their biggest game changer, that you can find people who have non-binary gender identities or who's are not cisgender or people who believe that Black Lives Matter or people who believe in a Green New Deal or people who want to march through Charlottesville carrying tiki torches chanting Jews will not replace us using the internet, right? That's like what the internet is very, very good at. And then when you found them, it also offers this whole set of scaffolding tools that we can use to coordinate our work together, whether that's, you know, brewing up dank memes in a secret Reddit forum and then dumping them into normie space, or, you know, writing code together and hanging it on GitHub, or cleaning up Wikipedia entries, or, you know, bulk buying hotel rooms in Charlottesville, right? It allows us to coordinate our work, petitioning our congresspeople, whatever. And the less time we have to spend coordinating, the more time we can spend working. And so ideally, if we can all agree where we want to end up, then we don't have to all agree on what path we're going to take to get there, right? If we say, all right, everybody, go have a great day in Disneyland, but at 6 o'clock we're riding Space Mountain, then we can spend our day organizing our day at Disneyland according to our own proclivities. One of us just wants to ride the Haunted Mansion all day, right? One of us is like, oh, I don't want to be late, so I'm just going to hang around Tomorrowland. One of us is like, oh, I hate Disneyland. I'm going to spend the whole time getting drunk at the Grand Californian, and then I'll, you know, sort of slosh back into the park in time to ride Space Mountain. And we still all end up in the same place, right? If we can all agree on where we're going, we can follow the different paths and the different gradients to get to the same summit. And what a normative framework does, what a vision does, is it allows people who don't know each other, who don't have time to talk to one another, who can't even find each other necessarily, to take what precious little time they have and nudge the whole system towards that state that we all agree on.
So Naomi Klein's No Is Not Enough describes what happened in Canada, mm-hmm, around the environmental movement, where people came together across a variety of different backgrounds and ideologies, developed a vision for the future that they then shopped to candidates, saying, this is what we want. Are, mm-hmm, you going to accept this as your platform or not? And I'm wondering if that's a model we should be thinking about, collectively forming a vision for the future that we, instead of having Elizabeth Warren say she's got a plan for it, we say to Elizabeth Warren, we've got a plan for it, and already factors in a number of different grassroots perspectives that are left out of the conversation.
Well, so that LEAP manifesto that Naomi and co wrote, I think, is really the foundation for the Green New Deal, right? It's the larval stage of the Green New Deal. So in some sense, that's already underway. And the Green New Deal, you'll note, although it has some pretty well fleshed out contours, there's also a lot of gray space. And that gray space is the space that is there for grassroots organizing, that is there for grassroots vision and grassroots demands. You know, the Green New Deal has like a federal jobs guarantee built into it, but how does a federal jobs guarantee work and where is it administered? You know, I know some people who are like, any federal jobs guarantee will devolve power to cities. And because cities are at the coalface, cities know what jobs need to be done. And so they, you know, it will just take the form of a grant that cities can use to hire people to do whatever jobs need to be done around the city. And there are other people who are like, no. We need a top-down view because climate is a, you know, top-down problem. It's no good to be addressing problems in your city if there's a new dust bowl and people are on the move from across America. You know, we need to figure out what to do when 20 million Californians end up in Minnesota because of wildfires. And that is not a thing Minneapolis solves for itself. And so those are all questions that are kind of open for debate and open for different visions. and open for different kind of grassroots activism as well.
Can I take this to a slightly different place and ask, in some sense, maybe a parallel question or the same question about technology? Mm-hmm. So I guess the way that I think about technology is that many of the norms that we've had in the past around what we do are based on limits of physics, right? Like you couldn't live in New York and work in LA because you couldn't get across the country fast enough, but mm-hmm. now you can. You couldn't be connected out all the time, but now you can. And so in this way, the norms that were, you know, sort of settled around what was possible, reasonably possible, have gone away because all these things are now reasonably possible. And it's very difficult for us to create new norms because what's possible is just changing all the time and more things are becoming possible. And norms take a while to establish, right? It takes time to get, you know, some sort of critical mass of humans thinking the same way. And so I guess when it comes to technology regulation, where I always come at it from is saying, like, we're always like chasing the tail of technology. We're so far behind. I mean, LawTrail is technology to begin with, mm-hmm. and we're even further behind when business models, technologies, users, regulation, everything is changing all the time. And so the idea that we're going to get ahead or ever going to catch up to how technology companies are building or deploying or utilizing technology just seems like impossible. So I guess the way I wonder about it is, how do we, as sort of Henry laid out, how do we say what we want technology to do? How do we get ahead of it and direct the market, right? How do we use norms to direct the market and to direct regulators and coders to the kinds of outcomes that we want, as opposed to telling them, no, you did that, we don't like it. Hmm. But like, no, it's over here. And I feel like, you know, they're in your networks and the way that we coordinate and the ideas of both hacking in ways that you could demonstrate things, but also creating that vision and using, you know, popular culture in all of its different forms or a story to kind of imagine these futures that we might say, you know what, that is the 6 o'clock meeting that we're going to have at Disney when we're going to get on this ride. And the ride is going to be that technology works in these ways where it's mostly disappears. It's only there when you want it. It's whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I wonder... Yeah, so I wonder in that space of changing of the like the onslaught of these big companies and moneyed interests against oftentimes user interests and or human interests, mm-hmm. whether norms can be whether it's possible to advance norms that become a counterweight and indeed a positive guide to help them to create more constructive technologies.
You know, I think that I just came back from Maine, so I want to say you can't get there from here. Right. The problem with the normative stuff, there is a normative story to be told about a technological future that is more pluralistic, right? Where there are lots more choices, where if you don't like Facebook, you can use something else. And it's not like all your friends are hostage on Facebook. They can use it too. And you don't have to convince them to leave behind all the things they like about Facebook. A more diverse, protocol-based, less product-based, more accountable internet, right? An internet where firms that upset their users don't get to capture those users because there's nowhere else to go. You know, Facebook lost its largest ever body of US users last year. They lost 15 million 13 to 34 year olds, but they all ended up on Instagram, right? Which is a Facebook subsidiary. But the reality is that the worst characteristics of tech companies are about their scale and not about the frailty of their executives. Right. The executives like tech exceptionalism is bullshit no matter who practices it. Tech is neither exceptionally sociopathic nor is it exceptionally virtuous. It is run by the same, you know, middle of the road idiots as every other industry. And the thing that makes Mark Zuckerberg's decisions so consequential is not that he is uniquely terrible nor that he is uniquely brilliant. It's that no one has put brakes on him locking up the social lives of 2.3 billion people. It's not that Mark Zuckerberg is uniquely unqualified to be in charge of those lives. It's that no one is qualified to be in charge of those lives. And the way that we got there was by allowing Zuckerberg and co. to violate antitrust law, that the laws that until the Reagan era prohibited mergers to monopoly, that's when you merge with a major competitor, prohibited buying nascent competitors to prevent them from growing to challenge you. The laws that prohibited creating vertical monopolies and enforced structural separations so that industries that had big platforms could not also compete on those platforms. Rail companies couldn't own freight companies. Amazon shouldn't be allowed to own companies that sell on Amazon. Those problems are really where everything else stems from, because those are the big limits we have on our technological self-determination, that not only are the firms dominant, but also they use that dominance to suborn the legal and regulatory world. So when they do get regulated, they are always regulated in ways that they themselves can bear, can comply with, right? No one is going to say, okay, the rule of Facebook is you can't be Facebook anymore, right? Instead, they say the rule of Facebook is a bunch of rules that only Facebook can comply with. And what that means is that you can never get a competitor of Facebook's, right? Facebook is sitting there going, please don't throw me in that briar patch, right? Please don't charge me a mere $100 million in compliance costs to ensure that no one ever challenges us the way that we challenged MySpace, which, you know, is a bargain. I mean, I still think Facebook's first preference is don't regulate me at all. But their second preference is definitely regulate me in a way that enshrines my dominance in perpetuity. And so I think that we can imagine a more pluralistic internet, and that's a thing that that would be really productive. But I think that like trying to figure out what a good Facebook looks like is probably a waste of time. I think a good Facebook isn't Facebook. I think, you know, it's like, what's good kudzu, right? We need a variety of interoperable federated services, not a giant centralized blob that lets one billionaire's decision affect the lives of billions of people.
I really appreciated you bringing that back to sort of market concentration and regulation and also a little bit of hope, right? Where you can imagine there was a history there where we did observe the Sherman Antitrust Act in different ways, which has changed. And I do feel like in so many of these things, there's stuff in our past and there are laws and practices and successes that it's, you know, in the way that we do often, all too often with technology, is we only look to the future and we forget that in the past there may not only be problems, but there may be things that still have relevance and can be adapted looking forward.
You know, the other thing that was present in the past and is still latent today is a sense of community duty to technology among technologists. You know, John Gilmore is famous for having said the internet interprets censorship as damage and routes around it. And what people, by and large, think that he meant is that the internet has this self-healing network architecture. And if a sensor were to snip a wire, the internet would route around that snipped wire just the way that it does route around a fallen wire. But what he meant, when he said that was, it was an era in which the internet was this tin can and string, bubblegum and baling wire system, Rube Goldberg system, that had these people who were true believers in it, the administrators of it, who just wanted to nurse this thing along because it meant so much to them. And whenever there was damage, they would get up in the middle of the night and go to data centers and reprogram things and pull new wires and find ways to route around things and get alternate network links and do all the things that it took in order to keep the internet alive. And what John was saying when he said the internet interprets censorship and routes around it is, should a sensor snip a wire, we would come together in just the way that we do now when a wire falls down to work with every hour that God sends to keep this internet that means so much to us alive and well. And the one thing that the tech companies don't have a lock on, the one thing that they struggle to get no matter what, is tech talent. Tech talent is in enormously short supply, and you can see the evidence of that in their actions. So the one time we actually got really serious DOJ antitrust scrutiny of the tech companies is when they conspired to have no poaching agreements between them, so that they wouldn't be recruiting one another's top technical talent. And the reason that these bitter enemies came together on that one question is their biggest business risk is not being able to hire enough nerds. They are really, really, really short on nerds. And not every nerd, but a lot of nerds feel a strong sense of identity with the free, fair, and open internet. They may not have a very sophisticated analysis of it. They may feel a little paternalistic and want to protect users from themselves and think they know better, but they care about it, right? And they, moreover, they also understand that the only way that they free themselves from working on Zuck's sharecrop is if somehow Zuck's dominance is lessened, right? They don't like the fact that they have to work for monopolists. There's no amount of baristas and massages at the workplace that can substitute for just being able to go off and do the heroic thing of getting a garage and starting your own company like Hewlett and Packard. And so those people have proven themselves in the last couple of years to be a source of enormous energy for positive change, right? The Googler walkout, the uprisings at Facebook over the Kavanaugh appointment and the fact that Facebook's chief lobbyist was in the audience to lend moral support to Kavanaugh and then threw a party for him afterwards at his own house, the uprisings at Facebook and Microsoft over contracts with ICE. You know, the big tech companies, even Apple, you know, spinning like crazy now to convince its engineers that it's not cowardly and wrong to block HK Live, which is the app that helps Hong Kong protesters avoid being beaten and murdered by their police. They really have to keep those engineers happy, because without them, they don't have a firm. They don't have anything. You know, no amount of money, no amount of lobbying power will keep them going unless those engineers, those administrators, those technical people continue to work for them. And, you know, they, more than any of us, I think, understand how important the internet can be to human thriving, because that's how they ended up there. They ended up there because that's where they found their people and their communities and their hobbies and their passion and their life and their love. And they don't want the network to be turned into, you know, five giant websites filled with screenshots from the other four. They really want this pluralistic, wild and woolly internet that we once had. So, you know, like to quote Orwell, right? If there is hope, it is in the proles. Right. Like those people do have it within their hands to effect enormous change. And it's another source of potential change that comes from science fiction, because that is an audience that reads a lot of science fiction. And, you know, they like to think that they're hero protagonist and not the evil billionaire with the floating garbage scows trying to put viruses in the minds of programmers, you know.
So write like the wind and give us some stories that help them, help the nerds and geeks inherit the earth.
Yeah. Well, or you know, be part of our glorious revolution at least.
Well, from hope to despair and back to hope again, and the future to the past and the future again. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us. Great to be with you both.
Yeah. Fuck Trump.
So the first thing I have to say about Corey is, wow. If you heard small popping noises during that discussion, it was either the sound of people's brains blowing up around the studio, or it was him dropping the mic after every comment that he made. But I think that, you know, I think that he has an extraordinary mind, and the ways in which you ask a question and he goes shooting off and along the way picks up a little world history, a little law, a little literature, a little technology, and can meld it all together by the end of a response is a rare talent. And I think it grows out of the movements he makes between different platforms and different ways of presenting his ideas to the world.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely a rare and incredible synthesizer and a curious one. And one of the things that I thought was especially interesting was sort of how he described his boing boing, the relationship to boing boing, and how that's part of his process as sort of a way to force himself to drive ideas deeper and further in a way that's also shareable and not just for him. And so I thought that kind of that suite of practices around daily writing and exploration of issues that he found of interest is a way to convert, you know, the same curiosity many of us have into ideas that are trending towards things that can be refined and explored and mashed up. So that to me was like, it felt like a great trick. You don't have to be Corey to use that a little bit.
No, when I was starting to start my blog, I sat down with Corey and just talked about the experience of blogging. And he was so encouraging and said, you know, if I've got 5 minutes in the day, I put something into Boing Boing. But you have to treat it as a deadline, because any given day, there are 50 things that are more pressing on your life than writing. and you have to commit to the writing no matter what. Because if you start saying, oh, today I was too busy, I couldn't do my blog, then you start losing ground and pretty soon you're not blogging anymore. And that happens to an awful lot of people. So you look at 20 years of Boing Boing and we see someone who's deeply committed to putting his ideas out in public space. And as a blogger, I really salute what Corey has achieved in terms of that. What did he say, 30 days out of 20 years or something that he'd not blogged?
Yeah, I mean, and also pretty awesome to imagine the community of other people who engage with those ideas, right? Giving him pushback, encouraging, seeing connections that he can't make. So it sort of shows what happens when you put early stage, you know, incomplete ideas out into the world for others to see and to build upon, right? That's the sort of that commons of idea space that's really powerful.
And I was struck by what he said about the blog being a space of normative change. You know, if we think about the Lessig four-part model of how we change the world, you know, code, law, markets, and norms. And science fiction for him functions in much the same way. I've been a huge fan of his work for years. I think I read Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom first, which is his expression of his Disney fandom. It's a story about a future where squatters have taken over Disneyland and individual attractions are at war with each other and people are redesigning. Inside the park, there are people who want to continually redesign and improve on the rides, and there are people who want to keep them the way they are. And that becomes a deep ideological divide between people. And that is very much the divide among Disney fans and Disney Imagineers about the park. In the Eastern Standard Tribe, he proposed this idea of time tribes. So, you know, globally, people getting in sync with, say, Eastern Standard Time or Pacific Time, because they're working with people in that other side of the world who are living in that time. And I think it predicts some of the ways people are working today. I mean, my assistant Jocelyn and I are, she's in Britain at this point, I'm in the U.S., but I think we're on the same time zone still in the ways in which we're doing our work. And I think that was really interesting. I love Little Brother, which is, to me, maybe my favorite all-time Doctor Who novel. And this one came out right after 9/11. He alludes to it a little bit in the interview. But I think of it as the My Side of the Mountain for the digital age, right? My Side of the Mountain, when I was growing up, told you how to live in the wild, and it's full of advice on edible plants and building fires and so forth. This is a story of a young high school-age kid who gets caught up in the crackdown on dissidents in American society that follows a terrorist attack, and how he survives on his own, how he goes off the web, how he's able to do hacking and organize politically. And it's really a guidebook for political resistance in the digital era and in the age of the Patriot Act. And we could just go down the list. I think all the stories in Radicalized also are asking questions of the moment and are pushing us to think in a normative way, change our thinking. There are provocations in the sense that Stephen Duncombe talks about, utopian stories, not as blueprints, but as provocations for discussion. And that's, I think, the way Corey uses science fiction.
Yeah, the having made it to the end now of Radicalized and really enjoyed each of the stories in there. We only really focused on one in our conversation, but I was just really taken with how he took these things that we see in the news every day in ways large and small, often disconnected, and spun them into provocations, as you say, right? On, you know, some of the most pressing and strangest things that we're facing right now. And at first, you know, they're kind of a little crazy, right? Like the Disneyland tale that you just told. And then they become very real and believable in the sense of you could see the trajectory we're on leading to those kinds of actual situations. So I feel like it's another extension of the Boing Boing work where he's, you know, as he was describing it, dealing with the responding to the things that he's thinking about every day. And it's a way to work through them. And, you know, I think in each of them, the happy ending-ish part is around the norms change, right? And the power being in the hands of the people, ultimately.
Now, he's definitely a power to the people kind of guy. And sort of the technology, technical skills, hacking as a kind of core civic literacy that's not only in the hands of individuals, but in the hands of groups that work together to bring about change. And I think about in the story we discussed about unlicensed bread, you see a whole community, the woman who starts to resist the copyright restrictions on her toaster begins to train all of the young people in the building how to recode all of the appliances in the building. And they gradually take over the building and make it their own. But then they discover there's going to be a crackdown, and she's got to persuade, not always successfully, the young people to reverse their acts of resistance. But that's that notion of collective change sets it apart, I was trying to argue, from the cyberpunks, which has typically had an individual hacker as a lone hero who takes down a corporation. And Corey really does think of social movements and collective agents when he thinks about how we change the world.
And I think this goes back to Lessig's Four Forces, right? And so it's interesting for me that he's at once putting out this provocation, this narrative provocation, and at the same time arguing that policy needs a narrative, right? We need stories to think about how our policies work, and very much he has this amazing creativity, and at the same time he's thinking really deeply about, in the case of, you know, social media company or tech companies, about market consolidation and what it means for any person, not just Mark Zuckerberg, but any person, to hold sway over billions of people, and just how inappropriate and dysfunctional that is, right? So that you have kind of a policy outlet that he can advocate for and discuss in very deep ways, policy considerations we should be thinking about and changes we should make, and also and narratives that go along with them to kind of imagine what happens when we don't make those changes.
Yeah, and that's I think what science fiction also does well, right? The sense of speculation pushes to the extremes either what the consequences of not changing the world are, or what the consequences of taking new approaches. Increasingly, that's a mode of political discussion. AOC and Naomi Klein put together this incredible video I recommend to people about the Green New Deal and the ways that it changes the world. And it's written from a future perspective. It's written from the perspective of a young girl, the job she got as a result of it, the experience she got. And by the end, she takes over AOC's seat in the House and becomes the future legislature. And so it's written in a future tense and looking back at what happened when the Green New Deal passed, which is a very different mode of presenting political ideas than we've typically seen in the past.
Absolutely. I mean, which, of course, brings us to Corey's new book on reconciliation after the Green New Deal, right? Which to me, as soon as he said that, I kind of was like, it was the mic drop moment where you think, oh, my goodness. I mean, we are the country and perhaps the world are coming apart at the seams on all these different fissures. And it's hard to imagine, A, getting past them, but B, if we do get past them, how we're ever going to come back together and be able to work together, live together, respect one another in the ways that perhaps, you know, I don't know that were ever the case, but certainly aren't the case right now.
So I was watching the new Maleficent movie the other night following our discussion with Corey. And without giving too much away, I think everyone probably can predict how this film is going to end. We have this lethal battle between two forces that kills massive numbers of people, and their bodies are still laden on the ground at the end of that battle. And then we have a wedding and everyone celebrates. And there's no moment of reconciliation whatsoever in that process. It's instantly, the wedding's the same. They don't even clear the bodies away. They just have this wonderful wedding that reunites the kingdom and everyone comes together again. And it was so absurd, especially after thinking about this process of reconciliation. Anyway, so that moment of the lack of reconciliation is an ongoing problem in our popular fiction. We just can't deal with it. And as a society, we have not thought about what we're going to do next. We hear this language this day about elections have consequences. But, you know, philosophically, democracy depends on the willingness to bring everyone else along after the result of the election, to renew the civic ties that hold people together. Otherwise, politics totally erodes the civic, and there's nothing left of the connections between citizens. And we've seen election after election now where we've taken no prisoners. We've slaughtered the enemy and left them with nothing. And there's been no willingness to have a reconciliation after the election. And if we go to something as big as the Green New Deal, there are going to be massive losses for some people and massive gains for others. And if there's no reconciliation, redistribution, acknowledgement of that, then I don't know how the society keeps healing from the kinds of political battles that we're going through.
And it seems hard to imagine, frankly, the politicians engaging in that sort of leadership around reconciliation, right? Maybe we get a national leader or some national leaders who can encourage some of that. But at this particular point in time, it seems hard to fathom, which to me underscores the power of popular culture to be able to do that norm shifting, to say, you know what, we can't have a take no prisoners attitude. We actually do need to have empathy for the vanquished and figure out how we can together move past this if we're going to survive.
So yeah, stories are our biggest hope, and we need writers like Cory Doctorow to write like the wind. We're coming to you from Studio B at the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California.
We are especially fortunate to have amazing producers, Josh Chang, Lena Bissay, and Sophie Maggi.
And we benefit enormously from the support of the MacArthur Foundation.